You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Stephen Wright. This is the first of a two-part interview. His most recent book is Going Native, recently published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. He's the author as well of M31, and his first novel, a Vietnam novel, was Meditations in Green. And I guess we're going to be mostly revolving around the subject of hallucinatory writing today. And I guess it seems to me that you've sort of anthologized here in these three novels abrasive techniques, and I'm wondering whether you might describe them. I mean, do you have rules for the alienation of prose?
Well, I wish I did. I suppose I wish it were more conscious than it seems to me. Or maybe I don't. Maybe it works better kind of doing it the way I do, which is the way I experience it, at least, is very much flying by the seat of your pants kind of writing. I'm not aware that I have any kind of conscious intent or any strategy that I operate from. It's almost just a matter of making one sentence after another and just trying to make it as good a sentence as I can and then moving on to the next one. I guess that what I'm looking for in every situation and every character is where the power is, and whatever it takes to get at that, that's what I use if I'm able to.
Is that really true? Because in Going Native, I notice, I don't know if I'd call them rules, but there are things that recur in each chapter. I guess some of them I noticed retrospectively when I saw in the final chapter that there's a scene plastered in from The Big Sleep in which Wiley does a Humphrey Bogart imitation of Bogart pretending to be a rare book buyer. I went back and
That's great you picked up on that.
Well, you know, that's our job. you know, and then I noticed you're getting fat, lay off those candy bars, some touch of evil.
Yeah.
It seemed as if each chapter would have one such movie appropriation, one mention of cheese down to a person taking a picture who says, "Say cheese," and I'm privy to the fact that the book was originally called Processed Cheese, so I kind of was hipper than maybe someone else would be. But it did seem as if each of these chapters had a set of not particularly arbitrary generating rules.
Okay, yeah, well, I understand what you mean now. Yeah, that is true. The reason for those sort of things is because the way the book is structured. I mean, it was a huge risk kind of building a book this way. It kind of has a built-in frustration, readerly frustration, because you're starting, stopping with each chapter being a different set of characters and usually a different locale. So I had to find other ways to hold it together. I did not want it to come across as just a collection of short stories, which it certainly isn't. And so I had to play themes, thematic notes, I suppose, running through it that would bind the separate pieces together thematically. And sometimes these are large, and sometimes they're, and probably more often than not, there's these small details like the sort you're mentioning. That's true. Those are all very conscious and very deliberate. And it's kind of, I see it as kind of glue that holds the whole book together.
I'm talking to Stephen Wright, the author of Going Native. Well, that kind of goo.
Or glue.
Glue.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's goo, too.
No. I have a bad L, that's all. You know? That kind of glue provides the notion of structure in a certain kind of novel. Georges Perec, for instance, seems to structure his novels, Harry Matthews as well, Calvino, out of nothing but hundreds of intersecting rules. And I wondered if that kind of writing appeals to you.
sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. I think there's a tendency for a certain kind of writer who employs this sort of method to get to be a little too more abstract than my taste admires. What I want to do is to have all that going for you, to kind of have it put together in a kind of invisible, abstract way, but at the same time have it, say, down on the line-by-line level, highly sensual. I think if you get the two things going, at least for me, those are the kind of books that I really like to read. And I hope that I at least approach that with this one. That is very much a conscious intent with
this. To visceralize this kind
of... Yes, you know. Exactly.
Do you... I'm curious about how you write. I was happy to have been given the first three chapters of this book 2 years ago by its original editor before it changed publishing houses. And I noticed, you know, because I'm a collecting sort, I'd kept these pages, and I noticed there are very few changes in those first three chapters. It seems as if you write to get it right and then leave what you got. Many times you would think a novel like this is structured by jumping around back and forth, but it seemed not to be the case.
No, and it seems to be it's the only way I've ever worked. For good or ill, I'm just one of these people that I work in sections, usually chapters or, say, with meditations, they were sections, really, and just keep working and reworking until I get it right, or at least close to right, or I'm just utterly disgusted by it, and then move on to the next. And it is very interesting to me also that in this particular book, a book that I began without really being totally sure of exactly how it was all going to go together, that it must have been there somewhere, you know, in the unconscious, really, that it's working its way out through the course of this book. Because I found that when I went back, I didn't have to change a whole lot. And this is, to me, is very interesting also because, as I said, I wasn't really sure exactly where I was going with it. But I ended each of these sections and then start afresh with the next one. And then it's just a lot of writing and rewriting and tearing up pages and crossing things out. And it's a long, arduous process, at least for me.
Had you known that marriage would take such an important role in the book when you began?
I'm not so sure if I was thinking so much marriage as I was what was going on between men and women, you know, whether they're married or not. I realized as I got into it, this is very much a kind of subtext that works its way through. There's something to do with intersexual struggle, say, in almost, not almost, in every chapter. And that became one of the themes also that kind of helped to hold the whole thing together. That's true.
I have a kind of pet subject, and we'll see whether you like to get into it. Some people don't. It seems to me that the history of American prose styles, at least in this century, has something to do with how people get high. That is, to me, it seems that what Hemingway invented was alcoholic prose, the clipped short sentences of someone trying not to seem drunk, spilling over into sentences, short sentences connected by "and," the drunk who can't stop talking. And the next,
and then went down to Faulkner.
Yeah. You know, then the next generation, the grass sentence, which I think of as the sentence of the swarm, of, you know, Ginsberg's sentences, too many things adhering in the same place, followed by the acid sentence, which is the hallucinatory sentence. I think of Pynchon particularly as the king of that. Then Coke comes along, and with it minimalism, the return to the short sentence, pared
down, quick highs. This is a great theory. I never heard this
before. And you are the first one, and this is why I ask, to create, one, crack prose, and two, the feeling of two prose styles intersecting as one character is drunk and the other high. Do you know what I mean? It feels as if two completely different vectors are operating within the prose. Do you have any, you know?
Well, I think I agree. I think I've never heard this before, but it makes sense. And, of course, you're also leaving out words themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is another high. And I think this is what I'm aiming for all the time, is at least to jack up the language to a point that it at least gives you the possibility of getting high from it. I don't know if this always works or not, but I think it's certainly one of my intentions, because the prose that I read and like, it does give you a sort of high. It certainly takes the mind consciousness to places that are not part of your ordinary, dull, habitual, day-to-day consciousness. I think that's the whole point of writing. I think you're right. I think it is based on a whole notion of kind of getting out of your head, which is very much a theme of this book in particular as a whole. I think it's a very deep-seated human need. And we don't have any choice in the matter. I think it's how we're put together, you know, starting as little children swinging themselves around and around till they're dizzy and falling down, to adults taking whatever, you know, drug is their particular one of choice. There seems to be a very deep-seated need to do this now and then. And we have problems then with it. Every culture, every society has problems in how you accommodate this particular human need to whatever particular society you're in. And sometimes the problems, you know, can be greater than in other cases. But I think you're absolutely right.
I'm talking to Stephen Wright, the author of Going Native, recently published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It seemed to me, when I was reading the book, as if this prose... I remember a friend of mine, when the early Tom McGuane novels came out, particularly Bushwhacked Piano, said to me, there's a little bomb in every sentence. He said, I don't know that I like the book as a whole, but I enjoy encountering the landmines from sentence to sentence. And Going Native, too, seems to be a book very much more influenced by the writing of the 60s and early 70s than the writing characterized by what was, for better or worse, called minimalism, where the sentences are sanded down to be featureless. I don't think they were. It was just a different aesthetic. I mean, it seems to me that Frederick Barthelme is as interested in surprise and weirdness as any of the other guys. But there was a desire to mass produce, to make sentences out of molds, and to use the stilted quality of banal language. Here it's all efflorescence and right. wildness. I wondered whether you came of age with those so-called 60s novelists, the black humorists and all.
Well, what names do you have in mind?
I guess the classical ones, John Barth, Pynchon, Nabokov, the people who were really Barthelme.
Well, I think, you know, a couple of them, but I think it kind of relates more to the actual nature of the style maybe than the time period. You know, as I listen to what you're saying, I mean, I can't help but think of Melville. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is that kind of writing, but it's not the 60s at all. It's the 1850s.
Except that Melville isn't zany or wacky. You know, the pop quality seems to come from particular time when pop art was being invented, and a certain level of horror of what the culture had itself created and mass-produced.
Right. Yeah. And I think you can't help but be influenced by, the nature of the reality around you. I think all that's going on. I would say out of those people, I mean, the two that really had a huge impact on me were Pynchon and Nabokov in particular. And see, those styles are much more similar, say, than to, the minimalists that I've never had much of a response to. I just have to admit that all of this just passed me by. I couldn't see what people were even praising, in it. It struck me as too flat, too boring, and too uninteresting, finally, for me.
Well, it seemed to me that if for better or worse and for not necessarily aesthetic reasons, that writing nevertheless responds always to its previous generation. And so it seemed to me to be a response to the preening and the peacock displays of those extravagant...
I think it was the wrong response, but...
sure. I mean, you know, to some extent, but...
I think this is the kind of writing where, okay, now I'm going to cut off this arm and see what I can do. All right, now I'll cut off my other arm. And my whole attitude is go at this with everything you've got. I think full-bore writing is the most interesting, and I think it's what the whole game is really all about. I don't understand this whole notion of, you know, trying to limit yourself and constantly getting into a narrow and narrower box, which I think where this kind of writing takes you. And it seems to have already fallen away. Its period was very brief.
Well, everything falls away. I mean, to some extent, I remember in 1970 that Joyce Carol Oates was the enemy. You know, she had appeared and was writing that kind of traditional story about real people going crazy in small ways around factories and rehabilitation homes. And everyone was going, oh, you know, we can't have this again. You know, and this isn't going to flower. And then, of course, it does and did. Went through a whole generation carver. You know, every kind of logging accident. And then, you know, you kind of settle down for the next thing. You know, it's very odd. This usually...
Yeah, well, it's all fashion. It's not much different than clothes, is it? And finally, what does it have to do with really good writing? The fashion comes and goes, and time seems to have a way of settling out what's worth keeping.
Well, it depends, you know. It depends on where you are, I guess. There's a certain period during which, and I'm always unhappy during these times, when the so-called arbiters of taste will announce to you that the writing that is of value is the writing that doesn't announce itself as writing, that doesn't insist on nudging you. And during those periods, you give people your favorite books, and they say, oh, too adorned, too, you know, fussed up. And then the next generation comes along, and you've got these encyclopedic and extravagant books again, and you give someone a very good pared-down story, and they say, oh, you know, too human, too regular, where are the monsters? And it's almost as if, you know, people don't really have a feeling for good writing in whatever form it takes, and it can appear
in
any
That's
form.
Right.
You know,
it's exactly
not
right.
aligned to a particular period style.
Yeah, and I find this endlessly fascinating. The inability that we seem to have, that every culture seems to have, to spot at the moment it happens, you know, kind of loaded dynamite. And it's very mysterious. Why isn't this immediately noticeable? I don't know. I suppose that's why I find it interesting.
Well, I bring this up because going native in certain ways seems to be about this process of stories losing their power. In the book's longest section, Night of the Long Pigs, is it called?
Right.
As in Beat the Devil, the characters penetrate into a jungle to find a tribe of not very far past. They were headhunters. And they're fans of Batman in the same way that in Beat the Devil, the ruler of the tribe wanted to meet Rita Hayworth.
Really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Take a look. I mean, it seems like a movie that you would love. In fact, Truman Capote wrote the screenplay for
I've
this.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about it. When John Huston And it's a big goof.
Right? And but nevertheless, as these huntsmen are watching Batman on their video with their American starlet and director guests, they respond to Batman as to a myth. And the book seems to be about the cycles during which myths go alive and go dead and repeat themselves in banal form, in savage form, in sophisticated form.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me that this was really a book about what gives or takes power away from primal myths. Does that make any kind
of... Yeah, I think I was operating out of a sense that there is this whole primal world that's been there from the beginning of time and is still there. It's here in this room. It's around us every minute. And, of course, we as modern, sophisticated people want to pretend that it doesn't exist. And the forces that, you know, kind of come from this world then manifest themselves in different ways, I think, depending on where culture happens to be at the moment. And I think that we, wherever we are right now, we're having a lot of trouble with this. You know, the whole lack of any sort of useful myth and the whole lack of even ritual that obviously was designed for centuries to kind of funnel... you know, desires, emotions, often ones that could be very disruptive to a particular culture. That's what all this stuff was all about. And we don't seem to have any avenue anymore for the play of these things other than pop culture. It just seems to me that a lot of what's going on in pop culture is the operation of what used to be termed, you know, primal myth. And I'm afraid that it just seems to me to be insufficient, that it's not doing the job, that pop culture is being asked, I think largely unconsciously being asked, to do something for all of us that I'm not quite convinced it's up to doing.
What is the job?
Well, as I said, I think it's to deal with a lot of fears, anxieties, and asocial impulses. And instead, we have everyone, or not everyone, but we have all too many people running around loose in our streets with nowhere for these things to go. And I think that's very much what was bothering me, you know, as I wrote the book. And, you know, ultimately you end up with a lot of murder.
So, in other words, your feeling is that pop culture... well, liberates antisocial impulses rather than channels them?
Well, it's... I don't think I could put it that firmly. It's very... it's a very difficult thing to grasp, I think. I think both, and maybe sometimes both simultaneously, which I suppose is what makes it a real interesting subject to do a novel on, because I think a novel is at least the one form where you can kind of... at least approach these sorts of ambiguities, you know, not seize them outright. And that's very much what I was trying to kind of encapsulate in this book.
I'm talking to Stephen Wright, the author of Going Native. I wondered whether there's been a lot of post-situationist interest in what's called, you know, carnival culture or spectacle culture, the society of the spectacle. And to some extent, at one of the orgies in Going Native, there is a disquisition about people watching people and substituting voyeuristic impulses for actual ones. And I wondered, you know, Is this book culture critique, or is that just to get the satire bouncing? I often get confused about whether a book's themes are simply the occasion for its language, which strikes me as being often the case.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know to what degree the messages that get darted at the reader from this book are meant to be taken seriously as ideas or whether they're just activators.
Right. Very interesting question. I think sometimes yes and sometimes no. And you're right. And I think sometimes the writer themselves may not be too clear on that. Often when you're involved, when you're there in your little workshop, you know, surrounded by all the debris and all the material you're trying to put together in some sort of pleasing shape, you're just willing to grab whatever is at hand and use it and go with that if that's going to get you to the next place. And so you're right. I think sometimes that that does happen. But on the other hand, I think also in the midst of all this process, you do hit on something that you know, just strikes you as true and genuine and pointed commentary on what's going on around you. So, yeah, I think sometimes yes, sometimes no. I think a lot in this book, it is criticism. But I, you know, saying that, I also have to say I don't – all it is criticism. I don't have – the book I don't think offers a necessary solution to what's being criticized. In actual fact, I don't see that necessarily as my job.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, that when T.S. Eliot said about The Wasteland that it was a set of metaphysical grumblings and everyone immediately says, oh, he's just being modest, I think he's telling the truth that, you know, to some extent – an artist takes the subjects nearest to hand or feeling and brings them through aesthetic process to their highest level of statement, but that might not be a level of analysis or critique or, you know, suggestion. You know, it may just be that the writer is the vessel for statement.
Yeah, well, simply to make something invisible visible.
Mm-hmm.
Is often an extraordinarily difficult thing to do and something that when it's done is very valuable. I think that's what a lot of books do for us, and I think that's why we need them. We need this constant sort of grumbling, you know, from out in the dark beyond the campfire, whether it irritates us or not. And more often than not, you know, it's irritating and disturbing. But on some level, even people that are really most disturbed by a lot of art, you know, whether it's novels or paintings, or sculpture, movies, whatever, still on some deep level, I think, must know that they need this and that even their being disturbed by it and grumbling back is a necessary and useful function, really.
Thank you. I've been talking to Stephen Wright, the author most recently of Going Native from Fairstrauss and Giroux. Thank you for joining me today.
Okay, thank you.
And we'll be continuing with this conversation next week. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Theo Mondel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.